8. Errol was calling my name when I returned to the room, sweaty and tired. I hadn't been gone long, just enough to have a look over Connor's grounds for myself. Still, I wondered how long he'd been calling for me.
"Must have fallen asleep,"
I called back to him, splashing some water with my hand.
"What do you need?"
"Your water must be cold by now," he said. "May I come refill it?"
The water was cold, but it was also perfectly clean, and I was filthier than when he'd left me.
"The water is fine,"
I said, undressing as quickly and quietly as I could.
"I won't be too much longer."
"The other boys left their baths long ago."
"Yes, but they were probably cleaning themselves while I was sleeping. Give me a few moments."
I dove into the water and scrubbed everything that would show outside my clothes. A thick stack of new clothes from Errol waited for me beside the tub. They were a gentleman's clothes, and probably cost Connor a fair amount of silver to purchase for all three of us. Mine had a linen shirt that laced up the front somehow, a soft leather half-sleeved vest with carved bone buttons, long linen pants, and a pair of calf-high boots. I didn't think much of my skin would show. That was only my first bath, because after I emerged from the room, Errol inspected my arms above the sleeves and observed that I still smelled like an orphanage. He insisted on scrubbing me the second time.
"The water is freezing," he said. "You like your bath this way?"
"It's colder now," I said grumpily, and I never said I preferred it, only that it was fine. Errol's gentle manners were not reflected in his bathing assistance. It surprised me how much dirt came off the second time. While he busied himself with a brush on the bottom of my feet, I looked at my fingernails. "Well, I don't remember them ever being this color," I said, then yanked my foot away. "That tickles. Are you finished yet? I don't like having a man help me with my bath." Errol grinned.
"Shall I have a woman sent in?"
I laughed and told Errol I wouldn't need anyone's help for my future baths. Obviously, Master Connor has a different standard of clean than the orphanage did. Now that I know you want the entire body washed, I'll make the necessary adjustments. After we finished, I sent Errol out while I redressed. I had to admit that he'd done a good job. It was possible I'd never been so clean.
"Where are my old clothes?"
I asked Errol after I'd finished dressing.
"Off to be burnt, I'd guess. They're not fit for much else."
"Get them,"
I said firmly, and then added,
"Just as they were before, Errol. Exactly as they were."
Errol considered that for a moment, then said,
"I can get them back, I suppose. If you do, I'll see that you get a silver coin for the service."
Errol tilted his head.
"Where would you get it?"
"That's a small detail and my concern, not yours. But it would buy months off your debt to Connor." I widened my arms. "These clothes aren't mine and they're not me. I suspect I'll want those other clothes back in 2 weeks.
Errol shrugged. "I'll see what I can do. Now come, the master is expecting you at supper."
Connor had bathed and shaved as well. He cleaned up nicely, now looking more like a noble and less like a road-weary traveler. Rodin and Tobias were already seated when I walked in. This small dining room appeared to be reserved for everyday meals and more intimate affairs. It was clearly designed to impress whoever ate here with an idea of Connor's wealth. I couldn't help but do the math on how much a clever thief might earn from stealing a polished silver fork or a gold-rimmed goblet, or a single crystal hanging in beads from the sconces on the wall.
"Sit, please,"
Connor said, motioning to the plate at his left. Tobias was at his right, and Rodin was beside Tobias. Rodin was clearly distressed that I had been seated closer to Connor than him. As soon as I sat, servants began bringing in the food. They started with cheese as soft as butter and fruit in the prime of ripeness. At the orphanage, we got the leftovers from the kitchens of the wealthy after they were too wilted or brown to be served at their tables, usually within minutes of the scraps turning to mold. Connor was served first, but he waited for the rest of us to be served before he began. Although I was served second, I assumed I had to follow the same guideline. It was a horrible temptation to ignore Connor's example and begin eating. My senses were overwhelmed by glorious smells on my plate and others coming from the kitchen.
"Do you eat like this all the time?"
I asked enthusiastically.
"All the time," Connor said. "Would you like a life of this luxury?"
"This exceeds any expectation I might have had for my life," I answered.
"It's a humble meal compared to a king's feast," Connor said.
"But who'd need a king's feast if they had all this?"
Rodin asked as his plate was served. Then he looked at Connor, knowing he'd made a mistake, but not sure exactly what it was. He searched for the words to correct himself, and failed. Tobias took his opening.
"I'd need a king's feast."
A girl reached over my shoulder and set a bowl of burnt orange-colored soup in front of me. She had dark brown hair pulled into a single braid down her back. She wasn't necessarily beautiful, but something about her was definitely interesting. Her eyes fascinated me the most, warm and brown, but haunted, maybe afraid. She frowned when she caught me looking at her, and returned to serving the others.
"Thank you,"
I said, getting her attention again.
"What kind of soup is it?"
I waited for her to answer my question, but none came. Maybe in Connor's home, the servants were not permitted to speak at his table. I turned away quickly, hoping I hadn't gotten her into trouble. Connor prattled on, telling us what we could expect to eat for dinner that evening. Crisp bread still steaming from the oven, glazed roasted duck with meat so tender it could be cut with a spoon, fruit pudding chilled from an underground cooler. I heard him, but continued to watch the girl as she refilled drinks for each of us. When she leaned to refill Tobias's cup, another servant bumped her with his shoulder, and a little water splashed onto Tobias's lap. Connor glared at her, irritated. I opened my mouth to defend her, but she handed him another napkin and hurried from the room before anything could be said. When we were all dished up, Connor picked up the spoon at the top of his plate and said,
"This is your soup spoon. It is for the soup and only for the soup."
Following his direction, I grabbed my spoon, trying to hold it the same way he did. It was an awkward, uncomfortable position. Maybe gentlemen had to feed themselves this way. Poverty-stricken orphans didn't. I was used to holding my spoon the same way I might grip an axe.
"You eat with your left hand?" Connor asked me. "That's unacceptable. Can you do it with your right?"
"Can you do it with your left?" I countered. Connor sounded offended.
"No."
"Yet you ask me to switch to my right."
"Just do it."
I switched hands but made no attempt to imitate Connor's delicate grip with this hand. Instead, with my axe grip, I went straight for the soup.
"No, Sage," Connor said. "Scoop the soup into your spoon by pushing the liquid away from you, like this,"
he demonstrated, and added,
"That way, if you spill, it will go onto the table, not onto your lap."
The last bowl of soup I'd eaten had been consumed by my holding both sides of the bowl and drinking it as from a cup. My right hand was sloppy, and as soon as Connor looked away, I switched back to my left. He noticed, but said nothing. Connor corrected Rodin on how to hold his spoon.
"It's not a hammer, boy,"
he lectured Tobias on leaning over his bowl.
"Bring the food to your mouth, not the mouth to your food."
But he said nothing else to me about manners. I suspected he'd given up. Following the soup, we had some bread and more cheese. Connor demonstrated the use of the cheese slicer and bread knives. I thought both of those were obvious, so I didn't pay much attention. Rodin and Tobias seemed captivated. The girl who had caught my attention before returned to clear our soup bowls and the bread and cheese while other servants brought us the main course. She frowned at me again, which bothered me because I didn't see what I possibly could have done so soon to irritate her this much.
"I'm already full," Tobias said.
"It's considered rude to say that," Connor said. "A host plans to serve his guests throughout the entire meal and does not want to think that he is forcing half his meal down their throats."
Tobias apologized and said his dinner smelled good, which Connor also seemed to think was a little rude. I didn't think Tobias meant to be rude. It's just that the way he said certain things made him sound haughty. I was plenty hungry, even after the first two courses. It had been nearly 2 days since I'd eaten anything substantial, and months since I'd ever eaten enough to consider myself full. Food is considered a luxury in Carthian orphanages. They operate on whatever money an orphan inherited upon the deaths of his parents, which inevitably is little more than the shirt on his back after debts were settled. Private donations come in from time to time by wealthy citizens hoping to buy forgiveness for their favorite sins. And like what had just happened to the three of us, an orphan was sometimes purchased from the orphanage by a wealthy family to be a servant until his debt was worked off. Since there was so little to eat, we learned to eat fast and to eat selfishly, which was why I hadn't understood Mrs. Turbledy's anger about my stealing that roast yesterday. It was meant for all of us. The final course was dessert, a cherry tart with cinnamon and sugar sprinkled on it. The same girl returned who had served me before, but this time I gave her no extra notice. Even if she had difficulties here, I had plenty of my own to worry about. I needed to focus on Connor, who had yet to reveal the worst of his intentions for us.
"Leave the room now," Connor ordered all his servants. "I won't need you again until we've finished our supper."
When the last of the servants closed the doors, Connor set his knife and fork down and clasped his hands together.
"We've come to it at last," he said, looking over each of us carefully. "I am ready to tell you my plan."
9. An hour seemed to pass before Connor continued. When he finally did, it was in hushed tones, as if he expected the servants' ears were pressed against the doors of our room.
"Some of you may believe you've already guessed my plan," he began, "but I assure you it is not treason. Indeed, in a roundabout way, it may prevent treason in King Ecbert's court. Carthia is on the brink of civil war, and very few citizens are aware of it. A major change is coming to this country."
"What is it?" Tobias asked. We all had that same question, but Connor's glare reflected his irritation at being interrupted.
"I will come to that in a moment," he said. "Do you remember what I told you about Veldegrath? He has long planned for this day, and even now has begun to amass those loyal to him so that he can force the rest of us to give him the king's crown. But other regents are also aspiring to the crown. They are quietly gathering their supporters. In 2 weeks, war will erupt in Carthia. It will split the country along lines of loyalty or alliances, and may pit families against each other, friends against friends, and town against town. Thousands will inevitably die in that war. Avenia, the country of your origin, Sage, is watching closely, waiting for an opportunity to strike. They are hungry for our rich farmlands, and the minerals our mountains provide. When Carthia is weakest and most divided, Avenia will strike, and swallow up Carthia with the force of a tidal wave. Avenia is a cesspool at best. In a generation, we'll be no better."
Connor tilted his head at me.
"Don't pretend to look horrified at my words, Sage. You know my description of Avenia is true."
"It is," I quietly agreed.
"Then you hope to prevent the civil war," Tobias said. "But you said yourself that you could never hope to become king."
"Do you remember this morning when I asked how many heirs King Ecbert has?" Connor said. "What was your answer, Sage?"
2, but as Tobias pointed out, I was wrong. There is only the Crown Prince Darius still alive. Ecbert's younger son was lost at sea.
"The younger son was named Jaren. Since coming to court, I've been told many stories about him, some of which could not possibly be true with the castle still standing in one piece."
"I heard he set fire to the throne room as a child," Tobias said.
"And he challenged the King of Mendenwall to a duel of honor when he was 10 years old," Rodin added. "He lost, of course, but not by much, so the story goes. We've all heard the stories, I snapped. What's the point?
Let me finish, Connor said. 4 years ago, when he was nearly 11 years of age, Jaren was to be sent north to the country of Bymar, always a friend to Carthia. He was sent there not only to be educated abroad, but frankly, to stop embarrassing the king and queen. However, on the way, his ship was attacked by pirates. There were no survivors. Pieces of the boat washed ashore for months, but Jaren's body was never found.
I did hear about this once, I said. Avenia was accused of hiring the pirates. If King Ecbert had any proof, he would have gone to war.
At least you know about your own country, Connor said. It probably was Avenia. Piracy is certainly their style. Some say the pirates have more power than the Avenian king. But Ecbert couldn't rule out the possibility that as a border country to Avenia, Galin had hired them. Both countries have easy access to the waters where Jaren's ship went down.
My father followed that news carefully, I said. He didn't want war, no matter what else was sacrificed. If he was still alive, my father would have been honored to fight on behalf of Carthia, Tobias said. I'm not the son of a coward. It would have felt good to defend my father's honor by punching Tobias in the face. But although my father was not a coward, he would have avoided being in a war at any cost. That fact was one of the last things he and I ever fought about.
Three regents have made the trip to Issyl, the seaport town from which Prince Jaren's ship launched. They seek any proof of his death. Or his life.
His life? Rodin sat forward in his chair. Is it possible Jaren's alive?
A body has never been found, Rodin, but if Prince Jaren were alive, then he would be next in line for the throne. Not Veldegrath or any other noble could claim it, and Carthia would be saved from civil war. Then Avenia would not attack.
But it's irrelevant, Tobias said. Ecbert and Eren rule now. Eventually, Crown Prince Darius will take the throne.
Connor leaned in closer to us. And this is the greatest secret of your lives thus far. They are dead. All three of the royal family. The few of us who know the truth have said the royal family is on a diplomatic mission to Galin. Meanwhile, their bodies secretly lie far beneath the castle.
We sat there, beyond shock and too horrified to breathe. The news that not just one, but all three royals were dead was impossible to bear. My stomach grew queasy at the thought of it, but I pushed those feelings down.
How did they die? I whispered. Murder. We believe they were administered some sort of poison at supper. They never awoke.
Any suspects? Rodin asked.
Connor dismissed his question with a wave of his hand. Don't be naive. Ecbert had many enemies, and frankly I wouldn't trust most of his friends. I believe all three family members were intended victims, clearing the path for a noble to become king.
So was it Veldegrath? I asked.
A lot of regents suspect him, but there's no evidence of it, Connor said. We shall see who puts themselves forward to be king, and then judge.
And you hope to find Prince Jaren and stop the nobles from fighting over the throne, Tobias said.
Not exactly, Connor said. Prince Jaren is long dead, and I can prove it.
How?
I asked. Connor smiled. I'm afraid for now I must ask you to trust me on that. It's my secret, and mine alone. However, since the regents are unaware of my proof, their trip to Issyl is only to end any official doubt before another king is chosen. That is where you come in. Because you see, many Carthians have small hopes that Jaren is alive. Nobody has seen him for nearly 4 years. He would be 14 today, about the same age as you boys. Surely the three of you have noticed certain physical similarities between one another?
He paused a moment, and his smile widened.
You also have similarities in appearance to Prince Jaren as he might look today. My plan is simple, really. I intend to convince the court that Prince Jaren is one of you.
10. A long silence followed Connor's announcement. This was worse than my darkest suspicions of why Connor might have taken us, and I was at a complete loss for what to do next. At best, the plan was lunacy, and at least, it was treason, no matter how forcibly Connor denied it. No sane person could hope to turn an orphan into a prince in 2 weeks. And a person would have to be even crazier to think that this orphan could then convince an entire court he was a long-lost prince. Tobias politely voiced these same concerns, but was waved off by Connor, who asked,
"Do you always think small, boy?"
Tobias swallowed.
"No, sir. Do you think this is too ambitious?"
Tobias found his courage.
"It seems like what you want would be impossible."
"Nothing's impossible. I haven't come to this plan lightly or without a great deal of thought. But to succeed, I must have a boy who believes this can happen."
"I believe it," Rodin said.
I snorted. Connor turned to me.
"You don't believe it's possible?"
"Just because it's possible doesn't mean it's wise." With arched eyebrows, Connor said, "And you claim to have this wisdom." "I claim to have nothing, sir."
"That is a good starting place. Now, Tobias, stand up."
Tobias stood, looking as nervous as if he were about to be asked the one most important question in the world, and he had no answer. As it turned out, Connor planned on doing all the talking. Connor said,
"You have the right shade of hair. The face is a little narrower than I would have expected for the prince, but the resemblance has potential. Your height is acceptable and build is trim, like the queen's. I like that you have education, but you are not as quick a thinker as I would want. If someone were to question you with an answer you did not know, I fear you might hesitate and spoil the plan."
Tobias reacted to Connor's assessment like he'd been punched. I couldn't understand why it bothered him so much. None of what Connor said were things Tobias had any control over, and it wasn't like Connor would find anyone he considered a perfect candidate. Next, Connor ordered Rodin to stand.
"Less of a resemblance to the prince when he was last seen, but a strong resemblance to the queen's family, so we may convince people of your identity. Your ambition and determination is admirable, though you often lack confidence when necessary. You are completely uneducated, which may also prove a problem. However, you're physically strong, which will give you an advantage with the sword and on horseback."
Connor told him he could sit, but Rodin remained standing and said,
"Sir, now that I know what it is you're seeking, I can make myself into this prince."
"Sit,"
Connor repeated, unimpressed by Rodin's pleas. He nodded his head at me and I stood.
"You have the entirely wrong color of hair, though we might color it over with the proper dyes. You show a preference for the left hand when it absolutely must be the right. Nor are you as tall or strong as one might expect from the son of King Egbert. You look the youngest of the three boys, though any of you will have to lie about your exact age. How are you at learning accents?"
"You ask if I can learn a Carthian accent in 2 weeks?" I asked.
"You cannot claim the throne of Carthia while sounding like an Avenian."
"It doesn't matter," I said. "I don't want the throne. Choose Rodin or Tobias, and I'll leave and go where you'll never see me again."
Connor's face twisted in anger. "Do you think I care a devil's inch what you want? You are here because despite a few physical setbacks, you have seeds of the personality I might expect for Prince Jaren. If we can weed out your bad manners and defiant nature, I suspect you could convince the nobles that you are him."
"If you weed those out, then there's nothing left of me," I said. "You'd strip those away and find I'm as boring as Tobias or predictable as Rodin. Why don't you take their physical similarities to the prince and give them a personality?" It was a rhetorical question. I didn't actually think either of them could adopt a personality.
"Prince Jaren was a fighter," Connor said. "You've done nothing but fight since we met.
And if you try to use me for this fraud,
Then I'll continue fighting, I said. You don't want a prince. You want a puppet. You've taken on this plan in secret. Why? Maybe you can't sit on the throne, but you plan to rule from behind it. Put Rodin on the throne. He'll happily let you guide his arms and feed him with the words he should say next. I won't.
Lower your voice, Connor said. I have no intention of ruling. Of course, at the end of 2 weeks, none of you will know enough about ruling to take that on alone. I will be there, to guide you as an advisor, to protect you, and to guard our secret. When you are ready to rule alone, I will serve in any capacity you choose for me.
Connor held out a hand to me.
I'm offering to make you the son of Carthia, brighter than the moon and stars combined, and you will take the throne, knowing that you have pulled your country back from the brink of war. How can you refuse this opportunity, Sage?
Carthia is not my country, I said, reaching for the doors to leave. Frankly, I hope Avinia destroys it.
11.
Mott was waiting alone on the other side of the doors. Obviously, he knew what would be discussed in there and had chased the other servants away. I stopped when I saw him, cringing a bit as I waited for him to clunk me over the head or commit some other act to force me back into Connor's dining room. There was no cowardice in my nervousness. His hits came without mercy, but he only nodded at me.
You clean up well, foreign orphan.
I had help.
Where were you going?
I scratched an itch on my face. Didn't really think that through yet. Somewhere I can be alone.
Mott apparently had no inclinations to leave me alone. He put an arm on my shoulder and steered me down the hallway.
Come with me.
We walked outside to a courtyard in the rear of Farthenwood, lined with torches that flickered in the breeze. On one wall were several swords. Each was different. One had a longer blade, another was thinner, another was jagged on one side. The tangs varied, from swords with a simple metal grip to ones wrapped in leather or crowned in jewels. One might appeal to a lifelong warrior, another to a mercenary. I suspected that one of these was supposed to appeal to a prince.
Choose one,
he said. How do I know the one that's right for me?
It's the one that calls to you,
Mott said. I reached for one with a medium-sized blade with a wide, fuller groove down the length. The hilt was wrapped in dark brown leather, and a circle of deep red rubies was set into the pommel. Almost as soon as I grabbed it, the sword fell from my grasp and landed on the ground. Mott darted forward and retrieved it, like I'd committed some sort of sin by dropping the sword.
This is obviously too heavy for you, he said. Choose another one.
It was heavier than it looked, but it's fine now, I said, lifting it with both hands. I chose it because it called to me.
Why?
I smiled. It has rubies on it. I could sell those for a lot of money.
Try it, and I'll use this same sword to run you through as punishment. Have you ever held a sword before?
Sure. I'd once held the sword of the Archduke of Montegrist, after sneaking into a room where he was staying. I'd taken it, just to admire, of course, while he was asleep one night. But I hadn't held it for long before I was caught. My punishment was thorough, but it had been worth it just for a few minutes of holding a sword as fine as his.
What's your training with a sword?
Mott asked. I suspect not enough to make a fair match between you and me. Mott smiled.
I heard what Connor said to you in the dining room. Despite what he describes as your limitations, you do have a chance to take the role of the prince. But you must learn and train and give yourself every advantage you can. Now raise your sword,
he demonstrated, holding his sword upright, nearly parallel to his body, and tilted outward.
Like this. This is first position.
I followed him and moved my sword as he did. Like this?
Get used to the feel of it in your hand. Swing it back and forth. Learn to control it, to balance it.
I obeyed. Despite its weight, I liked the feel of the sword. I liked me with this sword in my hand. It stirred up memories of how I used to be, before the day-to-day survival that comes with living in an orphanage. Still in first position, Mott said, "This is where you begin any basic attack."
"So I should avoid it then," I said.
Mott raised an eyebrow. "Why is that?"
"If it's that basic, then it's the first move everyone learns, which means everyone knows how to defend against that one."
Mott shook his head. "It doesn't work that way. Sword fighting isn't a chess game where you make one move, then so does your opponent."
I sighed. "Obviously."
Mott pulled a wooden sword off the wall, comparable to mine in length. "Let's test you then. See how you do for a beginner."
"Should I use a wooden sword too?"
That made Mott smile. "Even with a wooden sword, I can still do more damage to you than you'll do to me with that real one."
As soon as he finished speaking, he cut a line through the air past my sword and hit my shoulder.
"Would you at least try to stop me?"
he asked. I made a face and thrust my sword at him, but he parried it.
"Not bad," Mott said, "but be bolder. Prince Jaren was known for that."
Sounds like he's dead, so whatever his boldness was with a sword, it obviously didn't save him.
"Nobody could have survived so many pirates," Mott said. "Nobody on that ship did survive."
"And they probably all had swords," I said, swiping at empty air when Mott took a step backward. "So training me with one is useless."
"Relax your body," Mott said. "You're too tense."
"Why me?" I asked, lowering my sword. "Why am I here?"
"Why shouldn't you be?"
"Tobias is smarter than me and Rodin is stronger. Apparently, I have only slight resemblance to what he feels a prince would look like today."
Mott lowered his sword as well. "Tobias may be more educated than you, but I have no doubt you're cleverer. Rodin is stronger, but a strong heart will always overcome a strong body."
He smiled.
"And as for the physical resemblance, it would help if you cut your hair and stood up straighter. I can't see your face half the time you're speaking." "Now, raise your sword. Your problem is that you're trying to hit my sword. Hit me."
"I'd hurt you."
"This is a sword fight, Sage. That's the idea."
I raised my sword and lunged at him. He stepped toward me and slid his sword up the inside of my blade, then rotated and pushed it down. My sword fell from my hand and clattered to the ground.
"Pick it up,"
Mott said. After glaring at him for a moment, I picked it up, but I held it blade down, making it clear that I was finished with this lesson. He frowned at me.
"I had you figured wrong. I thought you'd be more of a fighter."
"Fighting for what? The privilege of getting myself killed one day like Ekbert's family? Even if I did what Connor wants, I'd never feel like a prince. I'd only be playing the part. Nothing more than an actor for the rest of my life."
"And what are you now?" Mott lowered his own sword. "You put on a facade of toughness, but I've seen you look frightened. You pretend to care for nobody, but I didn't miss your reaction when Latimer fell. And you pretend that you could run from your family in Avenia without looking back. But I hear the tone of your voice when you speak of them. I don't think you hate everyone half so much as you claim to."
"You're an actor now, Sage. All Connor wants is for you to act on behalf of Carthia rather than for yourself."
Mott had hit closer to the truth than he realized. I didn't want to think about my fears, or about Latimer, or especially about my family. I handed him the sword and said, "Thanks for the lesson, but I'll never be a prince."
"Interesting that you chose this sword then," Mott said. "It's a replica of the one Prince Jaren once owned. If Connor can look at you and see a prince, then it's about time you did the same."
12. Mott escorted me back inside Farthenwood. It was clear that his orders were to see I was never left alone. He described to me in detail how the copy of Jaren's sword had been forged only off a drawing Connor's father once made from memory, since Jaren's sword had been lost when his ship was attacked. I cared nothing about the story, and didn't even pretend to listen. "I should probably go back to the dining room," I mumbled.
"You're sweaty now. A gentleman would never enter a dining room smelling as you and I do."
"Then where?"
"Back to your room.
Rodin and Tobias will join you before too long. There's nothing to do in my room. Get some sleep. Tomorrow begins your training for Connor's plan, and I assure you it will be exhausting.
Are you going to chain yourself to me again? He smiled.
Of course not, but your room will be guarded. If you try to escape, the vigil will catch you and then notify me. Please believe me when I say you don't want to disturb my sleep for a second night in a row.
Are you one of Connor's servants too? I asked Maud. Does he own you?
I serve him, but he doesn't own me. My father worked for his father, so it was natural I should work for the son. I believe in him, Sage. I hope in time you'll believe in him too.
He killed Latimer. After telling him he was free to go, he killed him.
To be technical, Cregan killed Latimer, although it was on Connor's orders.
Mott was silent for a moment, then said,
Master Connor is not aspiring to be a priest and asks for no hero worship, but he is a patriot, Sage, doing what he believes is best for Carthia. Latimer never should have been chosen to come with us. It was better that he die than fail in the challenges over these next 2 weeks.
I think Connor wanted us to see him kill Latimer. Then we'd know how serious he is about this plan.
Perhaps, Mott said. And if that was his idea, then it certainly worked.
I stopped walking for a moment, forcing Mott to stop and look at me. In a soft voice, I said, The two boys who don't get chosen for his plan, is he going to kill them too? Mott put his hand on my shoulder and pressed me forward again.
He has to protect the secrecy of his plan. See that you get chosen, Sage.
Errol was waiting on a bench near my room when we arrived. Mott asked him to take me into my room and assist me with dressing for bed. I don't need help dressing, I said to them both. I solved the mystery of how to button a shirt long ago.
Help him, Mott repeated.
Errol looked at me, silently pleading with me to accept the order so he wouldn't have to face Mott. I sighed loudly enough for Mott to take notice of my annoyance, and then nodded my head at Errol. Fine, let's get this over with. Mott waited outside. Errol shut the door and began rummaging through the drawers of my wardrobe while I explored the room. Mrs. Turbledy could have crammed every boy at the orphanage into a room of this size, and it seemed like a waste of space to have only 3 beds in here. In sharp contrast to anything I ever experienced at the orphanage, the mattresses on these beds were deep and the blankets thick. Each bed had a small wardrobe beside it, and the desk was near the center of the room, facing a fireplace. The thought that I might never again have to live like I had at the orphanage filled my mind. If only that new life wouldn't come at such a high price. Which is my bed? I asked. Errol pointed to one at the far end of the room. That one. I want this one, near the window. That was meant for Master Rodin.
Master Rodin?
Errol missed the sarcasm.
Yes, sir.
Well, Master Rodin can have my bed. I'm taking this one next to the window.
Master Rodin has already been informed that this is his bed.
I pulled the covers apart and then spit on the pillow. Tell him what I've done. If he still wants it, he'll be sleeping with my spit. Errol smiled.
Yes, sir. Are you ready to dress?
I held out my arms and let Errol do the work. He worked quickly and quietly, which only made me feel more ridiculous. Errol, while we ate, there was a server girl, about my age, dark hair, dark eyes.
Her name is Imogen, sir. She came to us a year ago.
How?
Connor raised the rent on her family's home. They fell further and further into debt. Connor made an offer for Imogen to come work the debt off, though with the high rates on her family's home, she never will.
Why her?
Most of us think it's revenge. Imogen's mother is widowed. Connor proposed marriage to her years ago, but she refused. Some believe he wanted Imogen here so he could marry her instead when she became of age. But he quickly lost interest and assigned her to the kitchen.
Why?
She's a mute, sir. Not particularly bright, either. She performs her duties, but will never be anything more than a kitchen servant. There, You're dressed.
I laughed as I looked down at my nightclothes. Maybe I was too accustomed to sleeping in my clothes, but I felt overdressed. What's this? I asked, tugging at the outer garment.
A robe. You'll remove this before actually getting into the bed.
But I'm right here. I'm 3 steps from my bed.
Errol smiled again.
Something about me frequently amused him.
Would you like me to remove the robe for you?
No, I'll do it myself.
Can I do anything else for you tonight?
Where are my clothes I came here with?
I saved them for you, sir. They're being washed.
They didn't need to be washed.
Errol coughed. I assure you they did, but I'll keep them just as they were otherwise.
He busied himself with folding my clothes from the afternoon.
When they're returned to your drawer, will I have anything in return?
If he was hoping for a reward now, he'd be disappointed. I nodded curtly at him. When they're in my drawer, you will. You can go now, Errol. Tell the others to come in quietly because I'll be asleep.
Errol closed the doors of my wardrobe.
I saw Mott peek in at me while the doors were opened, but when they closed, I was finally alone. I opened the window, intending to climb out, but stopped as the cool evening breeze brushed against my face. Now the emotions washed over me like a tide.
Connor's plan was worse than I'd anticipated, and no matter what Mott had said, I knew I wasn't up to the challenge. I looked out into the dark night and wondered how long it would take me to run the length of Connor's property. Beyond that was a river that would mask my escape. I could walk all night and for as long as it took until I got to Avenia, to freedom. But I couldn't do it. Now that I knew his secret, Connor would never stop hunting me down. I was trapped here, and my choice was clear. Become the prince, or he'd kill me.
13. The next morning, my eyes opened before the servants came to wake us. The soft pastel light of morning seeped through the window at a low angle, so it must have been very early. I lay in bed for several seconds, orienting myself to the unfamiliar feelings of warmth and comfort. Then I remembered where I was and the strange game I was caught up in. The reality was stark and cold. I sat up in bed to have a better look outside.
You awake too? Rodin asked quietly.
Couldn't sleep any longer.
I hardly slept at all.
There was silence for a moment. Then Rodin asked,
What do you think happens to those boys Connor doesn't choose?
Neither of us lingered too long on the convenience of speaking of those boys as if they were strangers. After a slow exhale, I said,
You know the answer.
Rodin sighed as if he had hoped I'd have something better to offer.
The saddest thing is there won't be anyone to miss us when we're gone. No family, no friends, no one waiting at home.
It's better that way, I said.
It'll be easier for me knowing my death doesn't add to anyone's pain.
If you can't give anyone pain, then you can't give them joy either.
Rodin clasped his hands behind his head and stared up at the plaster ceiling.
We're nobody, Sage. I should have left the orphanage months ago, but I couldn't do it. With no education or skills, there was nothing for me on the outside. How would I have earned my keep?
Tobias would be fine on his own, I said. He could work in a trade or open a shop. He'd probably have been pretty successful.
What were your plans?
Rodin asked. I shrugged. Everything for me was just staying alive for another week. The irony struck me as funny. Now I just have to live out the next 2 weeks.
Connor has to choose me, Rodin said. It's not about becoming king or anything. We all know it's Connor who'll have the power. But for me, it might be my only chance in life. I know that sounds harsh because of what it means for you and Tobias, but that's just how I feel. You know the other day when you nearly got away from us in the wagon?
Yeah.
I wish you'd have made it. And if you have the chance to run sometime in the next 2 weeks, I think you should take it.
Good to know, Rodin. He'd like things to be that easy.
Why don't you two talk a little louder and maybe you can wake the entire estate?
Tobias said with a groan. Hush, I said.
Soon as they know we're awake, we'll get people in here. Tobias sat up on one arm. You and Rodin have been chatting like old friends all this time, and now you tell me to hush?
Hush, Rodin said.
Tobias lay back down.
I wonder what Connor has planned for us today.
We have 2 weeks to learn everything Prince Jaren would know, Rodin said. I think this might be the last moment of quiet we'll have until then.
It's really not a bad plan, Tobias said. Connor's right. This might be the only way to save Carthia.
It's an insult to the real prince, I said. When this is discovered, and we all know that one day it will be, what we are doing here will be worse than treason. For a nobody orphan to pretend to be a prince, who do we think we are?
Calm down, Tobias said. Who says it will be discovered one day? Connor will be there at every step to guide us. He has to, because he'll hang too, if we're found out.
None of us is a perfect fit to what the prince should look like now, I continued. Not to mention that 2 weeks isn't nearly enough time to learn everything he would know, whether Connor's there or not. If we three stick together, he can't force us to do this.
But I want to do it.
Tobias sat up and swung his feet out of bed.
You two can lie around if you want, but I intend to start learning what I need to as soon as possible.
He surprised the servants in the hallway, who insisted they had been waiting for us, though their sleepy eyes said otherwise. Errol dug into the drawers of my wardrobe, stifling a yawn. You can go back to bed if you want, I told him. I'm fine here.
You don't give the orders, Errol reminded me. Connor does. Your clothes will be more casual today to allow for the afternoon activities.
Reluctantly, I rolled out of bed so I could get dressed and Errol could get lost. I made Errol stand there while I dressed myself, although he insisted on inspecting me when it was finished.
Not to offend you, he said as I fumbled with a buckle, but it's obvious you've never dressed in clothes such as these.
I smiled. If I have my way, I won't have to dress in them much longer. Mott was waiting for us as we left the bedroom. He informed Tobias that he'd be working with a tutor in the library, while Rodin and I were trained in the basics of reading and writing upstairs, in a room that had long ago been converted from a nursery. Tobias smirked at us as his servant escorted him away. He probably figured that being more educated gave him an advantage with Connor, and he was probably right. Rodin whispered to me that he wouldn't want to study with Tobias anyway. I agreed. Our tutor was a man who instructed us to call him Master Graves, an appropriate name since he looked more like a gravedigger than a teacher. He was tall and thin as a shovel, with pale skin and limp black hair that he combed in a way to make it appear as though he had more hair than he really did. I immediately decided to dislike him. Rodin, however, seemed to be keeping an open mind about whether he was in fact a member of the Walking Dead. At least, when I whispered this possibility to Rodin, he smothered a grin and quickly told me to hush. Master Graves directed Rodin and me to sit in chairs that were clearly intended for small children and faced a chalkboard. He began to write the alphabet, and then said to me,
I told you to sit down and we'll get started.
Rodin looked up. He was already seated with his knees halfway up his chest. I folded my arms resolutely. I'm not sitting in a chair meant for a 5-year-old. Get me a real chair. Master Graves arched his head so that he could better look down on me.
You are sage. Obviously, I was warned about you. Young man, do not mistake me for one of Connor's servants. I am a gentleman and a scholar, and I will have your respect. You will sit in the chair I have available.
Since he was clearly still around to keep me from running away, I called for Mott to come in. When he ducked his head in the room, I said, Master Graves thinks he's not one of Connor's servants, but you are. I need a chair.
You have one, he said, nodding to the one beside Rodin.
It's too small. I can't learn that way.
Too bad. Sit down.
Okay, but when Rodin and I don't learn our letters, you can explain to Connor why.
Mott sighed and left the room. He returned several minutes later with a larger chair in each hand.
Master Graves was incensed, and said as punishment for my disruption, I would have to write my letters an extra 10 times that day.
10 times the better I'll know them then, I said. How strange that you should punish me by ensuring I come out more educated than Rodin, who has tried to obey you. Graves' knuckles were nearly as white as the chalk when he began instructing us on the sounds of the letters. Rodin actually seemed interested and tried hard to keep up with Graves. I fell asleep around the letter M. Graves was gone when Mott shook me awake some time later.
He called you incorrigible, Mott said. Honestly, Sage, are you trying to fail?
I already told you I could read a little. This morning was a waste of my time.
I thought it was great.
Rodin sounded happier than I'd ever heard him.
I never expected to be able to read, and Master Graves said he'll have me in a children's reader by tomorrow.
Great. Let me know what the children's reader has to say about impersonating a prince. Earlier that morning, servants had brought us a small breakfast of hard-boiled eggs and milk to eat while we studied. With such a paltry beginning, it was no surprise that both Rodin and I were already hungry again.
You'll eat after your next lessons, Mott said.
What lessons? I asked.
History of Carthia, then a lunch. Then you'll do sword fighting, horseback riding, dinner and etiquette with the master, and tonight you will study in preparation for your lessons tomorrow.
Rodin slapped me on the shoulder.
He'll make a gentleman of us yet.
I nodded but stayed silent. The thought of what Connor was making us into deserved no celebration. 14. All three of us shared the afternoon history lessons, which was a waste of Tobias's time because he already knew the answer to every question. He spoke so quickly, there was no point in Rodin and I even attempting to speak, even if we had known the answers. Our history tutor was Mistress Havala, who Tobias said had taught him other lessons earlier that day. She was past the age of marriage, which was curious because she seemed like a pleasant enough person. She had a round face with curly black hair that bounced a lot, and made a great effort to avoid any discussion of the real reasons why Connor had brought us here, even though it was clear she knew. There was a nervousness about her, yet her easy smile and gentle nature were a welcome respite from the serious demeanor everyone else on this estate seemed to have. I wondered what would happen to her at the end of these 2 weeks. When she stepped out to ask for a drink of water, I told Tobias and Rodin of my concerns. Tobias shrugged it off.
She'll be fine. She told me that Connor asked her never to talk about teaching us.
Threatened her more likely, I muttered. Defensively, Tobias arched his head.
If she doesn't talk, then it won't matter what Connor did.
It always matters. I looked to Rodin to agree with me, but his head was buried in the book in front of him as he tried to figure out the word at his fingertip. We all fell into silence as Mistress Havala returned. Tobias lapsed into a sort of daydream until Rodin and I failed to answer her next question, which he then answered without hesitation. Mistress Havala was an excellent tutor, and by the end of the class session, we could all name the major Carthian cities and describe their contributions to the country. Fortunately for us, few cities in Carthia can be considered major, so it was easy to learn them. Unfortunately for Carthia, their contributions to the country are equally unimpressive. The new prince would need to work hard to build up production of our natural resources. Predictably, Tobias announced he was up to the challenge. Mistress Havala raised an eyebrow at his words but said nothing. There was a knock at the door, and two servants entered carrying what I guessed was our lunch. I didn't know the first girl who entered, but the second servant was Imogen. She looked at me, gave her usual frown, then lowered her eyes. They set the trays down and left. Mistress Havala placed the book she'd been teaching us from on her desk, then handed us each a meat pie wrapped in a thick pastry. I ate mine in 4 bites and turned to Tobias, who was only halfway through his. "Can I have the rest of yours?" Tobias laughed. But I hadn't been joking. He finished the rest of his pie without answering me while Mistress Havala continued on. After our history lessons, Mott returned and escorted us to Connor's stables. Cregan was waiting for us there. His arms were folded so tightly as we approached, I briefly wondered if they were knotted.
"That's right,"
he said grumpily.
I'll be teaching you to ride.
After Mott was gone, he pointed to a saddle balanced on the top of a fence.
Let's start here. This is what you sit on to ride a horse.
You can't be serious, I said. Are you really going to treat us like it's the first time we've seen a horse? We can all ride.
I don't know what your skills are,
Cregan said. My skills are better than yours, I said. I can outride you with my eyes closed. Probably so can Tobias and Rodin.
Cregan's eyes narrowed.
Better than my skills? I'm not just a rider. I'm a trainer. I break wild horses, and I can break you.
I ignored that last part and said, I can ride anything you can ride. Cregan smiled.
You won't bait me so easily, boy.
Why not? Tobias said.
If he says he can ride, why not test his skills?
Cregan stared at Tobias, then me, then said,
All right, wait here,
and walked back into the stalls.
Thanks, I said to Tobias. Tobias glanced sideways at me. I'm not on your side, Sage. Hopefully this will teach you a lesson.
Our attention was diverted by a crashing sound in the stables. Slowly I shook my head and mumbled to Tobias, You don't think he has an untrained horse in there, do you?
Sounds like it, Tobias said.
Can you ride?
Rodin asked me. I've ridden before, is that the same thing?
No,
Tobias said flatly.
I can ride, but I'm not stupid enough to challenge Cregan to a wild horse.
Just apologize and tell Cregan you want lessons,
Rodin said. And let everyone hold that over my head? I asked. I'll just ride the horse in a circle or two. It'll be fine. Cregan was practically laughing aloud as he escorted a horse outside the stables. It was already trying to buck, and it was work for him to hold on to the reins. Cregan grinned wickedly.
So, you can outride me?
I backed up two steps. My father had warned me about my quick tongue countless times. Perhaps he should have warned me more often. It doesn't matter whether I could beat you or not. You're the tutor here. That seemed to offend Cregan. His voice rose in pitch as he said,
And as your tutor, I'm ordering you onto this horse.
I shook my head. I'm not riding that horse. Get me a tamer one and I'll do it. You just know you'll lose if you play fair.
Cregan walked so close that I could feel his breath on me.
Scared?
Yeah, I was. It was a fierce horse.
Then it's a good time to teach you some humility. Get on the horse or face the consequences.
Leave him alone. Sage was just talking big,
Rodin said. Cregan pointed a finger at Rodin.
Sage won't help you in the end, boy. Don't you help him.
Then he looked at me.
If you don't ride this horse now, then you won't ride again during the next 2 weeks. I'll tell Connor you failed here.
After a very long moment, I reached for the reins. Fine. But I need help getting up. Cregan laughed.
Can't even mount a horse by yourself.
It's a riding contest, not a mounting one. Where's your horse? Cregan's laugh widened.
He'll fall off so quickly I wouldn't even have time to get into a saddle.
He steadied the horse while I climbed on. The horse bucked, and I had to grip tightly to stay in the saddle. He doesn't like me, I said.
You should be used to that,
Cregan said.
And Windstorm is a she.
With a laugh, he slapped the horse on the backside. Windstorm took off with a fury at her feet, throwing me hard against the curve of the saddle. She bucked twice, and I managed to hold on only because it entertained the devils to help me do it. Behind me, Cregan was laughing boisterously. Maybe Rodin and Tobias were too. It was hard to tell with the world jostling around me. I yelped and held on as she pulled free of Cregan's control and we sprinted away. Windstorm headed directly for a tree, as if she knew the low-hanging limb could knock me off. I ducked in time to avoid the worst of it, though some of the smaller branches scraped my shoulders as we passed beneath them. Somewhere behind us, Cregan yelled for me to come back, but Windstorm was on a full gallop to freedom. Cregan was left with the reality that by the time he got a horse to follow me, I'd be long gone, and I was on a horse running so fast that if I fell off, I was facing more than a few broken bones. Or worse. 15. It was nearly dark before I heard them calling for me. I didn't answer the first few times. They weren't close enough to hear me, so there was no point in using up what little energy I had left. Finally, Mott passed close enough that I could see him through the trees. He was on horseback and carried a lantern.
"The devils have you, Sage, answer me! Where are you?"
"Over here," I called. I had hoped it would be Mott who found me. If it had been Cregan, he'd have likely beaten the last of my strength from me as punishment. But Mott seemed to hate me less. I might have a chance with him. He found me lying on the bank of the river, legs half submerged in the water. The water was cold and my legs had gone numb long ago, but numb was preferable to the ache I'd felt before. Mott cantered over and slid off his horse.
"There you are," he said, sounding more relieved than angry. "How'd you get so far away?"
Most of it was a blur in my mind, so I didn't bother answering. Mott crouched beside me.
"I told Connor he's a fool to consider using you as his prince."
"Princes ride in carriages, not on horseback," I said.
"As it so happens, a prince will often ride on horseback."
"Not with that horse."
Mott grinned. "No, not that horse. Where is she?"
"Long gone. I can't even tell you which direction."
"Connor will be furious. He was going to have her broken soon. Are you hurt?"
"I think bruises are the worst of it. She stopped to get a drink of water and I fell off." Mott chuckled.
"You stayed on through the ride and fell off when she stopped? Cregan's going to laugh all night about that."
I rolled the rest of the way out of the stream and pulled my legs up close to me. "Just tell him I stayed on through the ride, or he'll make lessons just as bad tomorrow."
"Sorry, but at some point you will have to learn that you can't say whatever you want to whomever you want. There are consequences for your sharp tongue, and this is one of them. I hope it will prove to be your most valuable lesson today."
Valuable lessons were code words for pain that no one apologized for. I'd had enough of them for a lifetime. "I'm cold. Can we go back?"
"You've got a cut on your cheek."
I brushed a finger over it, though in the darkness of the woods and with my dirty hand, it was hard to tell if there was any blood on it. It didn't feel wet. I think it stopped bleeding.
"Connor won't like that. He doesn't want to present a prince at court who's got cuts and bruises all over him."
"It'll heal by then." Mott extended an arm to help me onto the back of his horse. I stared at the ground for a moment and then looked up at him. "I need your help, Mott. Connor's never going to choose me just as I am." Mott took my hand and lifted me up.
"Not as you are right now. Let's get you back and cleaned up."
"Did I miss sword fighting?"
"We canceled it to look for you."
"What about dinner?"
"They're eating right now."
I can only imagine how Rodin and Tobias will talk about me to Connor. It'd be a miracle if they didn't talk him into hanging me at his earliest convenience. Mott began riding us back to the stables. The springtime night had cooled, and I shivered in my wet clothes. Mott must have felt sorry for me because he spent most of the ride instructing me on how to manage a wild horse. Unfortunately, I had other things on my mind, so I missed most of the lecture. Too bad, because what I did hear actually sounded interesting. Then Mott asked,
"What's your interest in Imogen?"
I shrugged. "Nothing. Why?"
"She passed me a note earlier today asking me to stop you from looking at her, so I'll ask again. What's your interest?"
"There's nothing," I insisted. "It's just that she seems so anxious all the time. Is she safe here?" Mott hesitated a moment, then said,
"When the servants feel one of them has been singled out or favored, they tend to get jealous. That can become dangerous."
I pondered that. "So you're saying when I look at Imogen, it makes things worse for her?"
"It could, yes."
Which left a horrible feeling inside me. I'd only looked at her to understand the cause of her fear, when in fact the cause of her fear was me looking at her. As we neared the stables several minutes later, Mott said,
"We were in a debate over whether you really can ride."
"Oh?"
Connor said he thought you could. He figured you had goaded Cregan into letting you have a horse so you could ride to your freedom. We weren't sure we'd see you again after tonight.
I chuckled lightly. Yeah, that would have been a good plan.
So can you ride? Mott asked. Or are you really so stupid as to have gotten on a horse that was bucking like that?
My soft laughter widened. Then I grabbed my chest.
It hurts to laugh. I must have bruised a rib. If you want me to tell you I'm that stupid, I will. The evidence is there.
Mott shook his head.
You don't have to say it, Sage. But you do have to get yourself under control. These 2 weeks are going to pass fast, and you're far behind the others.